Our shiur, we're learning this year Hilchos Shabbos, and we're going to continue where we left off last week. But in order to fully appreciate where we're up to, we're just going to do a quick review of last week, and then we will move forward. Just a public service announcement, next week I will be in Eretz Yisrael. We're having the shul's program there, so for those who might be there, you're certainly welcome to join us. For those who will be here, unfortunately there will not be a shiur, and we will pick up the following week. So let's continue with where we left off last week. We talked last week about how the Malachos on Shabbos are not really outlined so clearly in the Torah. You look through the Pesukim and Chumash, and you do not find that all of them are mentioned. You do not find 39 categories of Malacha. So the Gemara wonders, where do we know this from? If you look in Chumash, all you find is four Malachos that are mentioned explicitly. We mentioned that Choresh and Kotzer, plowing and harvesting, are mentioned explicitly, and the Ramban explains the reason why is because even though that was the staple of society back then, even though that was necessary for everybody to survive, the Torah still instructs us that we have to be careful to do that before Shabbos begins, and we cannot leave those activities for Shabbos. The Torah outlines not only that, it also speaks about Havara. That is, you're not allowed to create a new flame. And the Gemara asks, why is that singled out? Why is that mentioned on its own as opposed to any of the other malachos? So the Gemara tells us, because I would have thought that the only way to be considered a mechal Shabbos is if I violate all of the 39 malachos in one Shabbos. And here the Torah comes to teach us that even if you violate just one of the malachos by itself, like the malacha of lighting a fire, or any other malacha, we assume you're already considered to be a mechal Shabbos. And finally, the other one that the Torah mentions is hotzah, that you're not allowed to carry something outside without an eruv. And the question is, why is that mentioned? The Rishonim explained the reason why is because I would have thought hotzah malacha grua. All the other malachos are something that is either constructive or destructive. Hotzah, nothing happens. Nothing changes in status. The item that I'm carrying in my pocket or in my hand or on my shoulder is going to be carried regardless. It's going to remain the same as it was before, and it's going to be the same later on. So why should I consider that to be a malacha? It doesn't seem to fit the list of malachos, and yet the Torah says that is the rule. Hotzah is considered to be a malacha regardless. So we have to spend time figuring out what exactly are the lamites of us malachos, and where do they apply, and where perhaps do they not. So let's do a quick review. The Gemara told us that we mentioned last week that we learn all of the malachos from the activities that were necessary to construct a mishkan. So the Torah tells us, in the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, they had to build a mishkan. And there were many activities that were needed in order for the mishkan to be a functioning mishkan. All of the activities that were necessary for the mishkan to be built are ones that we are not allowed to do today on Shabbos, because the parsha of Shabbos and the parsha of mishkan are written one right next to the other. And from there we learn that all of the laws of Shabbos are derived from the Mishkan. Now, not only do we derive the laws of Shabbos from the Mishkan, but we also define the laws of Shabbos from the Mishkan as well. So take, for example, we mentioned last week that the Chasam Sofer brings a quote from the Yerushalmi. When you have the Malacha of Bona on Shabbos, you're not allowed to build, you're not allowed to do any construction on Shabbos. So the question is, what am I not allowed to build, and what perhaps am I yes allowed to build? Should we assume that a person is not allowed to build something, even if it's only of temporary nature, or do you assume no? The only time building is forbidden is when it's going to be a permanent structure. And the Yerushalmi answers that because in the Mishkan itself we find that the Mishkan was built in order to be taken down, and it was built again and then taken down, and they kept on constructing it and taking it apart, because that was the nature of the building that was done by the times of the Mishkan, therefore we assume that our definition of Bona B'Shabbos today as well is defined by the way it was done on the Mishkan. And therefore, even if you're involved only in a temporary building, we assume that is a violation of Bona B'Shabbos as well, because once again, that is not considered to be similar to the way it was done in the Mishkan. Once again, what you find is that the laws of Shabbos are not just learned from the Mishkan and derived from the Mishkan, but they are also defined, and they are also clearly navigated by the activities that were taking place in the Mishkan itself. Similarly, we mentioned last week that because in the Mishkan, whenever an activity was being done, there was specific intent for the activity to be done, and it was done in a natural, normal fashion. When they had to carry the beams from one place to another, nobody carried it under their armpits, and nobody put it on top of their head. People carried it in a normal fashion in which you would generally carry something else. And therefore, we assume if you do a malacha bishinui or kila'achar yad, if you do a malacha in an unusual manner, since it is not at all similar to the way it was done in the Mishkan, we assume that would not be a violation of a malacha. So the concern with that is, you could have a person who goes through the experience of Shabbos, turning on electronics, driving a car, writing on Shabbos, doing everything in an unusual fashion. As long as you hold the pen with these two fingers instead of the regular two fingers, and as long as you drive the car with a different part of your body, with your knees instead of with your hands, and as long as you type on the computer with your pinkies instead of your other fingers, we would assume that everything is permissible on Shabbos. There's no malacha. And the answer to that is the Chachamim were concerned about that, and therefore they instituted that it's aser midirabanan to do a malacha b'shinui. Even though as far as the Torah is concerned, there is no prohibition at all. Since we're talking about something that would take away from the whole ambiance of Shabbos, there would be no Shabbos otherwise. Therefore, the Chachamim instituted that you are not allowed to do anything b'shinui either. So that is a very important halacha. And once again, we learn that from the laws that govern the building, the construction of the Mishkan. And the final thing we mentioned last week is what we refer to as a davar she'eino mischavein and a psik resha. And we got into that because when the Mishkan was being built, we are told in the pasuk explicitly that it had to be done b'meleches machshebes. Everything that was done for the construction of the Mishkan had to be with intent, had to be with a mindfulness. And therefore we learn from there that any activity that you're going to do on Shabbos, the only way it could be violating a melacha is if it's done with the mindfulness, if it's done with a person's intent. If I want this consequence to happen, then it's considered to be a malacha. What if you have something, as we referred to last week, as a davar she'eino mischavein, which means I wear high heels, and once in a while, as I'm stepping on the grass, it's going to make a hole in the ground. And making holes in the ground is called choresh. You're not allowed to plow the ground. Now, we don't have plows. Most of us don't have farms. However, the malacha of choresh still does apply to us because we're not allowed to make holes in the ground or furrows in the ground. So what if I have high heels and I'm wearing them and once in a while it's going to make a hole in the ground? The answer is that would not be a malacha because it is an unintended consequence. There's your kula for the day. It's an unintended consequence and it's something that I had no interest in that happening at all, and therefore we assume that would not be a malacha at all. However, the chumra for the day, if you have high heels that are of the nature that every time you step on the grass, they're going to make a hole. I don't know if they make such a shoe, but if you have something very pointy or cleats, let's say, on sneakers, where every time you're going to walk in the ground, it's going to make a hole or it's going to make something happen to the ground, then we assume that's what we refer to as a psik reshe. That is inevitable that that's going to be the outcome, and therefore we assume even if it's not what you intended, that would not be permissible on Shabbos. So therefore, if I have my refrigerator and I forgot before Shabbos to turn off the light in the refrigerator, happens to be in our home, my wife sets an alarm every Friday. You know, you can set everything on your phone, so she sets an alarm every Friday, turn off the light in the refrigerator. Now, sometimes you're in the middle of doing 100 other things and the alarm doesn't help you because by the time you get downstairs, you're going to forget. But it's something. It's something to try and remind ourselves that before Shabbos, you should make sure to turn the light off. What if I forgot to turn the light off? And now my whole kitchen is lit up. I don't really need the light in the refrigerator. It doesn't make a difference to me. But I know with certainty that every time I'm going to open the refrigerator throughout the duration of Shabbos, I'm going to be turning on and off the light. So you'll say it's a davar she'eino mischavein. I have no interest in the light being on. I can see very well inside of the refrigerator without the light. The answer is that doesn't help. Why? Because since it's inevitable that every time you open up the refrigerator, that is going to happen. Therefore, it is something that is not permissible on Shabbos. So this is a very important halacha, and it's something we need to be aware of. And I'd like to pick up right where we left off last week with an issue that is referred to as misasik. And the truth is, until this Matzah Shabbos, I was planning on giving a very different shiur this week, and 5 minutes of the shiur was going to be the issue of misasik. And we had a number of girls in the house for Shabbos, and I asked all of them, so how much do you know about misasik? They all went to Beis Yaakov, and they all are learned and went to seminary, and I assumed everybody knows everything about misasik, so I was planning on only talking about it very briefly, and all of them told me they've never even heard of the concept. So I'm glad that that came up, because today we're going to dedicate the entire shiur to misasik, because it's a very important concept, and it's something we need to understand before we engage in the laws of Shabbos. So misasik means, it's a funny term, because it's a little bit counterintuitive. For anyone who knows Hebrew, lehitasek normally means to be involved, to do something. I am engaged with something. In the Gemara, misasik means when you are oblivious. Misasik means when you do something and unbeknownst to you, there is something that is taking place. And I have absolutely no idea that that is happening. So the question is, what is the status of misasik? Not only with regard to Hilchos Shabbos, but with regard to all other laws of the Torah as well. I do something and I have no idea that I'm doing something wrong, is that considered to be a avera? Is that considered to be something that I need to do tshuva for? Is that something that, look, I had no idea there was something wrong, and therefore I don't even have to do tshuva? That's a major question. We do have a concept in Chumash called a karban chatas. What does a karban chatas mean? It means if a person violates a certain kind of avera, and you did it inadvertently, let's say, I thought today was Sunday, and it turns out today was really Shabbos. So I'm going about my day like I would normally spend my Sunday, and then somebody informs me, by the way, today was Shabbos, and I can't believe it. That would be something that would require a karban chatas. I would have to bring a karban to the Beis HaMikdash to gain an atonement for all the mistakes that I made over the day. Let's say I keep the laws of I'm keeping Shabbos. I know today is Shabbos. I happen not to know that you're not allowed to dig a hole in the ground, and I happen not to know that you're not allowed to write on Shabbos. I was never educated. I never knew. And now somebody informs me that what you were doing was absolutely prohibited on Shabbos. We assume that is called a shogeg. You did it. You didn't have any malicious intent in mind. I didn't know that it was forbidden on Shabbos, but I wasn't well educated. I wasn't well informed. That is something that would require a karban chatas. That's not what we're talking about. What we're referring to here is even less than that. Mit aseik means when I do something and I don't even realize what I'm doing. Not that I know that I'm writing, I just happen not to know that it's forbidden, or that I'm driving my car and I happen not to know that it's forbidden to drive a car on Shabbos. Here we're talking about I do something and I don't even realize what I am doing. For example, I walk into a room and there's an automatic sensor and the light goes on. I had no idea that by opening the door that was going to happen. Now I walk in and I see that I activated a whole system and I turned on a light. Am I obligated to bring a karban chatas? Is that considered an avera at all? Is that something I have to worry about? Or is that, look, I had absolutely no idea that such a consequence was going to result of my opening the door. Who would think such a thing? Now, nowadays, maybe we should be a little bit more well-informed because we live in a world where many of these things do happen. But that generally we refer to as a misaseg, and that's what I'd like to talk about today. So by way of introduction to that topic, let's first look at the pasuk with regard to Hilchos Shabbos, where we're told in the Aseres HaDibros, Lo sasa kol melacha. We are not allowed to do any melacha on Shabbos. Ata means you, men and women alike, uvincha and your son, uvitecha and your daughter. Ask the Medrash, I don't understand. There's an obvious question. Ata means every adult, means you. Men and women, everyone is responsible to make sure that you keep Shabbos. So what does it mean, bincha uvitecha? My children are also ata. If my children are adults, they're obligated to keep Shabbos because it says ata means you have to keep Shabbos. So why does the Torah go out of its way to teach us you have to keep Shabbos, ata uvincha uvitecha? What do we learn from bincha uvitecha? Says the Medrash. Lo sasa kol melacha number beis. Ato vincha vitecha. What is it referring to when it says bincha vitecha? Elu haktanim. That means even young children. O eino ela hagdolim. Maybe perhaps it's referring to adults. Says the Medrash, how can it be referring to adults? After all, it says ata, which refers to all adults. So bincha vitecha is included in the ata. So what do we mean when we say ata uvincha uvitecha? Says the Medrash, V'halo kvar mizharam be'ma'atzmam, ha-matam alomar, what do we learn from the words, ata uvincha vitecha, elu haktanim? It means that my children are also not allowed to do melacha on Shabbos. Rashi on Chumash quotes this Medrash, and Rashi writes, therefore, if I see my child is about to go and perform a melacha, I have an obligation to stop them. And people mistakenly think that because one is a youngster, because one is a child, they are not obligated to keep the laws of Shabbos. That might be true that they won't be punished for violating the laws of Shabbos because they are children. However, as a parent, as an adult who is watching, we have an obligation to make sure that our children do not violate the laws of Shabbos. And very often, if there's a light that is off on Shabbos, some people will pick up a five-year-old kid and tell them to turn the light on. We are not allowed to do that on Shabbos. Absolutely forbidden. You're not allowed to do that at all because we are told explicitly, it's not my chumra, it's a pasuk in Chumash where the Torah states, Ata uvincha vitecha. We have an obligation to make sure that our children also refrain from doing malacha on Shabbos. Once again, they might not be punished for doing a malacha. After all, they're not responsible for their own actions. They are, after all, only katanim, they're minors. But we have to make sure that our home is a home that keeps Shabbos, which includes not only adults, but it includes children as well. Now, it's very nice. The problem with that is, why is it necessary to have a pasuk explicitly by Shabbos that warns us of that prohibition? After all, we have three psukim in Chumash that we already learned this concept from. Pasuk says in Parshas Emor, we're going to read through Gimel, Dalet, and Hey. All three of them are quoted together in the Gemara Maseches Yevamos Daf Kuf Yudalet, where the Gemara teaches us a very important principle that applies to all the laws of the Torah. For those who just came in, there should be extra sheets on the Bima. So the Pasuk says in Parshas Emor as follows. We have a prohibition on Shabbos. We have a prohibition throughout the year to consume blood. One is never allowed to consume blood. That is something that is forbidden. It's considered machalas asuras, it's treif. So the Pasuk says, Al kein amarti livnei Yisrael. Therefore I have instructed, I have informed the Jewish people. Kol nefesh mikem, every individual, lo sochal dam, you are not allowed to consume blood. So Rashi points out, quoting the Gemara, what does it mean, I told the Bnei Yisrael, kol nefesh mikem, every soul. Obviously, if you told the Bnei Yisrael, it means all of the Bnei Yisrael. So what does it mean, every soul? Rashi says what it means is, lahazir gedolim al haktanim. That means that not only do the adults have an obligation to make sure they don't consume blood, but the adults have an obligation also to make sure that children do not violate this aveira. The adults have to make sure that the children do not consume any blood either, because that is considered to be machalas asuras. That is case number one that we find where the Torah instructs us, make sure that not only adults don't do the aveira, but adults are also responsible to make sure that children do not violate the aveira. Case number two, the pasuk in Parshas Emor, when it outlines all of the mitzvos that a Kohen must abide by. So there the Torah tells us that a Kohen, a male Kohen, is not allowed to go. He's not allowed to attend a funeral. He's not allowed to be in contact with a dead body. He's not allowed to go to a cemetery unless it's one of the close relatives. But otherwise, he does not have a right to attend. He cannot defile himself. What about young children who are the children of Kohanim? So the Pasuk says, Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, Emor al HaKohanim b'nei Aharon v'amarta aleihem. God tells Moshe Rabbeinu to instruct the Kohanim, Lenefesh lo yitama be'amav. They are not allowed to defile themselves. They are not allowed to come in contact with a dead body. Rashi says, Emor el HaKohanim. Why do we have this double terminology? Emor el HaKohanim, instruct the Kohanim, ve'amarta aleihem, and tell them again. Why are you telling them the same thing twice? They just heard it. Answers Rashi, quoting a Gemara. What it means is, Emor ve'amarta. You have two instructions. Not only are you instructed to tell the Kohanim that they have to be careful for themselves, but you have to tell them, V'amarta, they have to be careful for their children as well. They are responsible for their children. So if a Kohen has a minor, a young boy, who thinks that he wants to attend his, you know, the funeral of the next door neighbor, who is not a close relative, we would say, even though he's a minor and he's not going to be held responsible for the avera that he does, but as the parents, we have to make sure that he does not defile himself. He is not allowed to go and attend the funeral, because after all, emor ve'amarta means not only are adults responsible to abide by this law, but children are also responsible. And finally, the third example that the Torah gives is the example of achilas shratzim. We're not allowed to eat certain insects, certain animals. We don't have to go into the list. And there it says, lo ye'achelu, they are not allowed to be consumed. Once again, Rashi tells us there, L'chayev es ha-ma'achilan niktanim. Not only is an adult going to be held responsible for eating something that is permissible, that is prohibited for them to eat, but even if an adult feeds it to a young child, that is not permissible either. So we have three examples where the Torah tells us that not only are we responsible for our own actions, but we are responsible for our children's actions as well. And the question that the Rishonim deal with is, why? Why are we concerned about the children? After all, a child is just a minor. A child is not held responsible for their own actions. Why are we concerned whether or not a child who's a Kohen is going to a cemetery or a funeral? Why are we concerned whether or not a child is going to eat kosher food or not? What's the difference? Why should it bother anybody? So the Trumas Hadeshen, a very important sefer, most of the psukim of the Rama are based on the Trumas Hadeshen. So the Trumas Hadeshen writes in number Vav the following reason. Ha da isi kra da asra Torah, de lo leisfu le biyadayim. This that we learn that the Torah instructs us, that we are not allowed to feed a minor something that is not permissible for an adult to eat, or we are not allowed to help them, we are not allowed to assist them, to violate an avera, to drive them into a cemetery, to bring them to a funeral, we're not allowed to be involved in that, says the Trumas Hadeshen, maybe the reason why is dekapid rachmana shelo yargiloso lavar averos, because the Torah was concerned that when the child is going to become an adult, kisheyigadol yivakesh limuda, when the child is going to become an adult, he's not going to know that now life has to change. So it's important that we already get the child used to it as a minor to make sure that when it comes time for them to really be responsible on their own, they will know how to act. That's what the Trumas HaDeshen argues. And this is the way he explains why the Torah goes out of its way to instruct us that not only are you responsible for yourselves as adults, but you're responsible to make sure that your children abide by the law as well. Now, if that really is the only reason, this is extremely relevant, and it's a unfortunate relevance, but it is something that comes up quite often. So Rav Moshe Feinstein discusses the same thing that the Chasam Sofer discussed in the 1800s. It's a very important issue, and that is if, unfortunately, somebody has a special needs person in the family, a member of the family, who needs to go to a special program. Not always can they go to a program that is a Jewish program, and not always can they be sent to a program within the community that keeps kosher. Sometimes you need to send such a child who has a very severe mental disability, needs to be sent to a certain institution where they don't have kosher food, and where they're going to be training them to do certain activities to become more productive. But the problem is, you don't have the ability to send them to an institute where they're going to serve them kosher food. Now you're going to tell me that as a parent, I have an obligation to make sure that my children don't violate an Aveira. If the whole reason that I have to make sure that my children don't violate an Aveira is only because when they become older, when they become an adult, and they have an understanding on their own, we have to make sure that they know how to act. Well, here we have a child that's never going to come to an understanding. Unfortunately, it just doesn't change. When you have a child that will never understand what Shabbos is, when you have a child that will never understand what eating kosher is, when you have a child that has no grasp of any godliness or anything, not any godliness, but any interaction with God as we generally know it through the performance of mitzvos, what do you do with a child like that? Do you assume that you have every right to send the child to an institute, to a program where they're not going to serve kosher food, where they're not going to be keeping Shabbos? Or perhaps would you say that would not be required? That is a major question. And the Trumas HaDeshen, based on the reason that he gives, it would seem to be that you have every right to send him, because here you have a child, a boy or a girl, that will never come to an understanding of what the mitzvah is all about, and it will never be a consequence for them when they become an adult, and therefore we don't have to worry. That is generally not the assumed opinion. Generally we assume, no, the Torah goes out of its way and tells us we have to make sure that our children are keeping to the mitzvahs. And I think it's a very uplifting message. It's a very uplifting message because sometimes, unfortunately, and it's obviously changing in our community as a whole, but unfortunately special needs children sometimes, and certainly those with developmental and severe mental disabilities, are not given the chance to really have the opportunity to connect in the way that they can. And it's an important message here to show that, yes, this child may never come to an understanding on their own of what kashrus is, of what Shabbos is, but it doesn't make a difference. As parents, we have an obligation to engage them in any mitzvah that it's possible to engage them in. And it means that as parents, we have an obligation to make sure that they keep Shabbos on their level however much they can, and that they eat kosher on their level however much we are able to ensure that that happens. And we cannot write off a child. And we never say, just give the child up to an institute and whatever happens there. We don't do that. Now, obviously, if it's extenuating circumstances and there's no way that the child will ever get the services that are necessary for him or her to become a little bit more high-functioning, there's what to talk about, there's what to discuss, and you have to figure out exactly the parameters of what might be permissible, what might not be. But in general, I think it's a very important point, it's a very important concept, that we need to do whatever we can to make sure that they are considered equal citizens when it comes to the opportunity to perform mitzvahs on their level. I know that Rabbi Mark Penner has a special needs child, and I'm not embarrassed to say that. He talks about it very publicly. And he has gone to incredible lengths to try and find venues for his child to be engaged in Jewish life. And I know that when his son became a bar mitzvah, I know he was training him for months to sing Adon Olam or something. Obviously, the child cannot be the chazan. He doesn't have enough cognitive understanding to be the one to be doing something for everybody else. But have the child be engaged. Let him, maybe if he's high enough functioning, let him put on tefillin. Let him have an understanding. Let him come to shul. Let him sit with everybody else. Why shouldn't he? And yes, he might walk up and down the shul and disturb a person or two. Okay, so you figure out how to make it the least disturbance possible, but there's no reason why a child like that should not be brought to shul, or why a child like that should not be given the opportunity to open the Aron Kodesh on the Shabbos of his bar mitzvah, or to say Adon Olam at the end of davening. Let him feel accomplished. Let him feel that he has a place in our community, as he absolutely should. And that's a very important point that comes out of this issue. Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, I once saw, has a very beautiful passage. I spoke about it a few months ago I think there was a Yachad fundraiser here in somebody's house. I don't remember where it was. But I, at the time, I mentioned what Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes, that he says he thinks it's a communal obligation. The same way we have an obligation to build a mikveh, you cannot have a Jewish community without a mikveh, and you cannot have a Jewish community without a shul. So much so that we assume you can force people, even if you have, let's say, individuals in the community who are too old and are no longer needing the mikveh, or you have women who are not married and there is no need for them to use the mikveh. We assume that as a community, we all have to contribute to make sure that a mikveh is built. Does it mean you have to spend $10 million on a mikveh? No, but it means that when we have a communal need and there's a mikveh that needs to be built because there's a deficiency in a mikveh, everybody has to contribute, even if you're not somebody who personally needs it. Writes Rav Shlomo Zalman, that applies to a mikveh, that applies to a shul, it applies to every communal need. And he said it applies to making a place for special needs children in our community. This is Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writing, that's on the same level as the community's obligation to build a mikveh and to build a shul and to build a school and everything else. He says we have an obligation to build a institute that is going to be able to help these children develop as the greatest children that they can become. And I was so moved by those words, because here he's writing that even families who don't have the necessity, even families who don't have that special needs child, even families who don't need those services are still obligated to contribute, because after all, this is part of a Jewish community. And we don't write children off. And just because there's somebody who might not be able to perform a mitzvah the same way somebody else might know how to do it, doesn't mean that we ignore them. And it doesn't mean that they are not to be taken seriously. And it doesn't mean that we don't create a venue for them. Right, so Shlomo Zalman, we have a communal obligation like we have for every other institute in a community. We have a communal obligation to provide that service for them. And I think it's a very important point. So back to where we began, and that is, we find that the Gemara teaches us, number one, by eating non-kosher food. Number two, by eating blood. And number three, or drinking blood, I should say. Or number three, the reason I said eating blood is because the Torah says lo sochal dam, you're not allowed to eat, which is a question. Why doesn't it say lo sishta dam? So it's a question in and of itself. Not for today's shiur, but anyway, the Torah says in three instances, by eating non-kosher food, by consuming blood, and by a child of a Kohen attending a funeral or going to a cemetery, we assume by all three of those, the adults are responsible to make sure that the children don't violate it either. So here's the following question. The Shulchan Aruch writes, if you look at number Zion, that the same way that a Kohen is instructed not to be metame himself, that he's not allowed to defile himself by attending a funeral, so too muzharim hagdolim al haktanim, so too the adults are responsible to make sure that their young boy Kohanim, their young male Kohanim, do not attend a funeral either. So the question that is raised by the Shach is the following. You have a woman who is pregnant, and she wants to attend a funeral or a cemetery. Now, this is probably the most commonly asked question all year. I'm pregnant, nothing to do with a Kohen. I'm pregnant, and I want to go to a funeral, and some heebie-jeebie rabbi told me I'm not allowed to go. It is made up. It is bogus. It comes from nowhere. There is no source for that at all that tells us that a woman who is pregnant is not allowed to attend a levaya. It's just not true. Well, we're not up to there. I'm talking about regular. The question that we get throughout the year is, my grandmother died and I want to go to the funeral and my mother is telling me I can't go. It's just not true. It's just not true. If you want an excuse not to go, I always tell people, you can say, I'm pregnant, whatever. Everybody knows pregnant women don't go. It's a different story. But if you really want to attend the funeral, there is absolutely nothing wrong. There is no source in halacha at all that indicates that there's a problem going to a cemetery. Same thing. There are other things that the halacha does say for a pregnant woman, but nobody follows those, like going to a zoo, right? So nobody follows that. So whatever. It says if you're going to look at certain animals, who knows what your child's going to look like. Now, okay, we don't follow that, and we certainly don't have to follow something that is not mentioned at all. That is not a halachic principle, it's not a halachic concept. Second kula for the day. A pregnant woman is allowed to attend the funeral. So let me just get to the point. What if you have a pregnant woman who is married to a Kohen? You have a pregnant woman who is married to a Kohen. Now, is she allowed to attend a funeral or a cemetery or perhaps not? What would you say? Well, this is a major problem. Mm-hmm. Right. Two. That's correct. You're saying because the child is considered a child. So somebody asked last night at the shiur, wouldn't you say the child is like living in its own little world there? So what? The child didn't go to the funeral. The mother went to the funeral. The child is in like a little bag. So I asked this woman, let's take a different case. You have a woman who wants to become a convert, a non-Jewish woman. So she wants to convert. What is the process of conversion? She obviously has to go to classes and do everything that needs to be done. But one of the most important parts of the conversion process is going into the mikveh. So now she goes to the mikveh. She's a bona fide Jew. No questions about it. She's absolutely Jewish. The question is, what about the child? What about the child that she has not yet given birth to? She's given birth as a Jew, but she conceived a non-Jewish child from a non-Jewish man. So is the child Jewish or not? The answer is the child is absolutely Jewish. Because the mother goes to the mikveh, we assume that her going to the mikveh counts for the child as well, because the Gemara tells us, Uber Yerachima, we assume the child is a part of its mother. There happened to be the Shulchan Aruch writes that the Beis Din has to be aware that the woman is pregnant at the time, because they have to accept. They have to say, we are accepting the woman as a convert. We are also accepting the child that is inside as a convert. But one mikveh experience is enough for the child as well. You don't have to go again. I remember there was a story a number of years ago where there was a woman who was going through a conversion, and she went to the mikveh. And right before she was finished with the process, so the Beis Din asked her, are you pregnant? Now she was like 2 weeks pregnant, and she was embarrassed. She didn't even tell her family. She didn't tell anybody yet. So she said no. She didn't want to tell them that she was pregnant. Then a few months later, she realized, maybe because I lied to the rabbis, maybe my conversion doesn't work either. Now, that's certainly not the case. Her conversion certainly works. The question is, what's with the child now? So that was a very serious question. When you have a situation where a woman goes to the mikveh with the child inside, normally it works as long as the Beis Din is aware. What happens when the Beis Din is unaware of the fact that she was pregnant and now it turns out that she was? So that's a very important issue, but be it as it may, we assume the child is considered a part of the mother, and that's why when the woman converts and has a child inside, we assume the conversion works for both, and the child is born as a Jew. The child is not a convert. The child is considered a Jew. They don't have to convert the child again when it's born. We assume the child is Jewish. So here, the question is, when a woman goes to a cemetery and she is married to a Kohen, so the woman herself has nothing wrong with attending because the only prohibition is on a man. But here she's pregnant and she might be pregnant with a baby boy who is a Kohen himself. So the question is, does she have to make sure not to attend a funeral or not to attend the cemetery? So the Shach raises this issue and the Shach writes, well, you have a 50-50 chance, maybe it's a boy, maybe it's a girl. And so he said 50-50 is not good enough because 50% chance that you might be doing the wrong thing. But then he says you have a 25% chance that even if it's a boy, it might be a nephil, it might be a stillborn. And therefore he says, since it's 75% chances that the child is not going to be a boy, you can rely on the 75% and assume you're allowed to go. Now, two reasons why that might not be so applicable to me. Number one, because it's no longer a 50-50 chance whether it's a boy or a girl. We know with certainty whether it's a boy or a girl. Correct? Nowadays it's very easy to find out. Now, some parents choose not to find out, but if you have the ability to find out, shouldn't you have an obligation to find out? So that's number one. Number two, it is not such a high likelihood that maybe this child is not going to be a healthy child that's going to come out alive. Yes, once in a while that happens. Somebody just gave me an article the other week, Chaim Abitan, gave me a great article from the New Yorker. I just have to tell him next time he gives me an article, it shouldn't be 25 pages long. Still haven't finished reading it. But it's an amazing article about a woman who is a doctor, and she thought she was a know-it-all, and she was pregnant, and she was all excited that she's going to be the one to dictate exactly how everything's going to happen, and exactly when she's going to go into labor, and exactly when the baby's going to be born. And the reason he sent it to me is because a couple of weeks ago in a shiur, I mentioned that the Gemara tells us that one of the things that was never given over to human beings is mafteach shel chaya, when a woman is actually going to be the moment of birth that we cannot predict with accuracy. We can say we think we know, but we can never know with certainty exactly when a woman's going to give birth, unless obviously we do a C-section. But if the woman is going to naturally give birth, we don't really know exactly when that's going to happen. So he sent me this article that this woman was planning everything and everything was supposed to be exactly so, and it turns out everything from beginning to end went wrong. And she showed up and she was in labor for days and days long, and everything was complicated and nothing went as planned. And here she was writing an article how you can be a doctor and you can be well informed and you can know everything about medicine, and still obviously there's a God and there's somebody else who's in charge and there's someone else who makes sure that the child is going to be born this way or that way at this time or the other time. And that's really the case. So over here, although we have advanced so much in the world of childbirth, and we know from this article, you can see it on your own, it's an amazing article, how much it shows the development of all the procedures that are done and used to be done, and how high the likelihood used to be for a woman to either pass away during childbirth or for the child to pass away. The numbers are astronomical. It's unbelievable how much we've advanced in the last 50 to 60 years in this area of life. So yes, in the days of the Shach in the 17, 1800s, maybe it was true that 50-50 chance, boy or girl, you don't know, and 25 chance maybe that the child is not going to be born alive. So maybe you can say a woman who's married to a kohen has a right to go to a cemetery. But when we're talking about a situation where nowadays it is easy to find out, and there's no difficulty in finding out. Every time you go for a sonogram, the doctor is able to tell you with certainty whether or not it's a boy or a girl. So that's a major question. Plus, given the fact that it's not as likely that the child is going to lose its life today, we assume that most pregnancies are going to end up being ones where the child is going to come out alive. Yes, unfortunately, it happens otherwise sometimes, but this is something that the wife of a kohen needs to be aware of and needs to think about whether or not she has a right to attend a funeral, because perhaps she is carrying a baby boy inside, and that is something that the Torah says we have an obligation to beware of, not only that adults should not be metame to a mace, but also that children and minors as well have to be careful not to defile themselves as kohanim and not to attend a funeral or a cemetery. So, where do we get into all this? We have a concept throughout the laws of the Torah, which is that we have an obligation as adults to make sure that our children don't violate an avera either. Not only are we responsible for ourselves, but we're responsible for our children. So Rav Chaim Moser, the great gadol in the 1800s in Europe, asked, in the 1900s, sorry, he wanted to know, why do we need a specific pasuk by Shabbos that tells us, Ata uvincha vitecha? We have to be explicitly told that by Shabbos we have to make sure that our children don't do any malacha. Don't we already know that from every other law in the Torah? The same way our children, if we are kohanim, are not allowed to attend the funeral. And the same way that we assume our children are not allowed to eat non-kosher food. And the same way our children are not allowed to violate any other aveira in the Torah. Shouldn't we assume that our children are also not allowed to violate one of the malachas on Shabbos? And we shouldn't need a specific pasuk to teach us this when we're told, Ata uvincha uvitecha. Question is clear? I think the question is clear. Okay. So, two answers are suggested. Answer number one, writes Reb Chaim Moser, goes as follows. Generally, throughout the laws of the Torah, we assume the only time I'm responsible for my child is when I'm helping to facilitate that child do something wrong. So, tonight we have nothing for dinner. I go quickly to the non-kosher pizza store. I buy a slice of pizza and I give it to my child. That's where I violate the aver. What if my child on his own goes to the pizza store and buys a slice of non-kosher pizza? I had nothing to do with it. I didn't give him the money. I didn't drive him there. I didn't feed it to him. He did it on his own. Is that my problem? So the Gemara assumes usually not. Again, you have a problem at home that you have children who are doing such things. But as far as the Torah is concerned, is that considered my responsibility? I didn't do anything wrong. I had nothing to do with it. I didn't facilitate the Avera. So the Gemara assumes in such a case, that's not my problem as an adult. You have a chinuch issue at home, but it's not really a problem that I'm going to be responsible for because, after all, I did not facilitate. However, writes Reb Chaim Moser, when it comes to the laws of Shabbos, if my child violates the laws of Shabbos, even though I didn't facilitate the Avera, I didn't put the child in front of the light to turn it on, and I didn't do something to make the child be encouraged to do this malacha, the child did it on his own, without my help, and without my assistance, and without my encouragement at all, we assume I have still violated the Avera of Shvisa b'Shabbos, because here the Torah goes out of its way to tell me, Ato vincha vitecha, and this is above and beyond our obligation for most other averis in the Torah. Normally we assume, you just have to be careful not to be the facilitator. By the laws of Shabbos, we assume it goes beyond that. By the laws of Shabbos, we assume, even if I am not facilitating anything, and my child is doing it on his or her own, you are considered responsible because we assume you, as the adult, ata uvincha vitecha, you have to make sure that your home is a home that keeps Shabbos. And that includes adults, it includes children, it includes everybody, and you have a responsibility for them as well. Now, if my child walks into the room and just starts turning on and off the light and I have no idea about it, I'm not held responsible. But the question is, if I'm watching, I can't just sit back and say, oh, my kid is going to do whatever they want. No, I have to make sure that I get involved and stop the child from doing what he's doing. Yeah.
So in your first example, the pizza shop, where the father
That's a very important question. So there, did anyone here ever hear of Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg? So he was the Shrida Esh, a very fascinating personality. There's a sefer that they put out. He was a Holocaust survivor. He was a tremendous gadol, and after the Holocaust, he had a lot of traumatic damage because of what he saw and what he experienced. But he was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, and they have a sefer. I don't think it was printed by him. I think it was printed posthumously by either members of the family or people who were close with him. I don't know exactly the history, but it's called Lifrakim. So when I grew up, I had it at home. My father had it in the house. And as a child, I remember he showed it to me. It's a beautiful sefer. It's the letters of Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg on many different issues. So it has speeches that he gave, and it has his notes on certain occasions. So he has a letter in there. It's a famous letter about celebrating a bas mitzvah, that times have changed today, and even though a bas mitzvah never was celebrated, but today we need to encourage women to celebrate their connection to Yiddishkeit. It's not the way it used to be in the shtetl, whatever. He has all kinds of very important letters in this sefer Lifrakim. But one of the issues that he discusses in there is exactly what you're mentioning. And he says, it used to be that when a child became 13 years old, or the child was considered to be an adult, we would say, Baruch Shapatrani Me'oncho Shelazeh. We would say, I absolve myself, now it's your problem. Now I'm not responsible anymore. He says that was when the child at 13 was expected to move out of the house, to be responsible, to have their own job, to support themselves, to get married, and to do everything. So what do you want from the parents? How long can I be held responsible for my child after they're already an adult and they're on their own? What? After my kids get married and they have their own children and they're running their own homes, I'm responsible to make sure that they're doing everything right? How can that be? That's an unrealistic expectation. Therefore, he writes, this is a copy of a drasha that he gave by a bar mitzvah. It was a very beautiful piece, a couple of pages long. But he writes there that he thinks today the nature of this mitzvah has changed. Yes, it's true, chinuch used to be very different, but he says today when our children stick around our house and they're more dependent on us, even after they're married sometimes, right? So you have children who are considered to be a part of the parents' upbringing for much longer than they used to be. How can you say at 12 years old, okay, I'm wiping my hands and now it's your problem? It's not your problem. It's still my problem because the kid is still living in my house. They're still under my auspices. They're still under my influence. And I'm responsible to make sure, even after they become an adult, that they are going to abide by the laws of the Torah as well. So the point you mentioned is a very important one. Should the nature of that mitzvah change today? The nature of chinuch maybe used to be until a certain point, and then you say the child is on his own, or on her own. But today, where we're talking about a situation where the children are considered to be dependent for much longer, and the children are considered to be under their parents' guidance for much longer, so maybe we should assume that the nature of that mitzvah of chinuch would change as well. I think it's a very compelling argument that he makes, and he argues that in the society that we live in today, and he didn't live that long ago, he lived in the last 100 years, and certainly since his passing, it's become even more compelling of an argument. I think it's what to think about. And he said a parent should never think that just because a child becomes an adult, that means that their job is over. He writes, that's where the job is just starting. Your child is going to go out into the world and go to high school and college and do whatever they're going to do. And it's a complicated world, and he says our obligation as parents is far more consequential, is far more critical than it ever was, because our children are faced with a much more complicated world than they have ever been. My father keeps telling me today he's happy not to be raising children now. I said, thanks, Dad. And it's just becoming more and more complicated. It's not so easy, and it's something we need to very seriously consider. What are we doing to make sure that our children have the greatest opportunity possible to be abiding by the laws of the Torah in this very complicated world that we live in? So as we said, yeah. That's a good question. Hard to know. Yeah.
We have so many examples about the children. Mm-hmm. Do you have any examples about when it says hata, that it includes the women? Because look, here we are saying ha uviteva.
Mm-hmm. So it does do. Why would you assume that hata does not include women?
Because hata does not include women.
Why not?
No.
Moshe Rabbeinu is talking to men and women alike. So he says, Ata, everyone who is in the assembly is obligated to keep the laws of Shabbos. Of course it was both. No, there's no doubt that when it comes to the laws of Shabbos, men and women are considered to be equally responsible. There's no question about it. There's no reason for the Torah to say both. When Moshe Rabbeinu is referring to men and women, because the boys and girls were not there. When Moshe Rabbeinu is giving the instruction that boys and girls were not sitting at the shir, Moshe Rabbeinu is talking to the adults and he says, you as responsible adults, men and women, have an obligation toward your children, both the boys and the girls. I think that's what it means. So, One answer that we gave, why is this specifically mentioned by the laws of Shabbos, is because by the laws of Shabbos, we assume even if I don't facilitate the Aveira, I'm still responsible for my child. So if I see the child turning on and off the light, I have to take them away from it. If I see the child is playing with a toy that every time they play with it, it's activating a system or turning on music or doing something like that, I'm supposed to get involved and take the toy away or take the child away. Do something to make sure that your child is not going to violate the laws of Shabbos. That is answer number one. Answer number two that we are going to suggest is also a very important one. We mentioned, and this is what the whole shiur is predicated on, the last 40 minutes were just the introduction. By the Mishkan it says, Meleches Machsheves, that everything that was done had to be with a mindfulness. Everything that was done had to be with specific intent. Over here on Shabbos I would have said, children don't do things with specific intent. When a child turns the lights on and off, they're just looking for a game to play with. They're not doing it because they want to do a malacha. So I would have said that that's not called a malacha at all. I would have said my children could do whatever they want, because after all, that is not maleches machsheves. And the only way to violate a malacha on Shabbos is if you have specific intent for the activity that you are doing and the consequence that results from that activity. Therefore, I would have said that children are not obligated at all by the laws of Shabbos. They're not bound by it. Therefore, the Torah has to come and tell me, Ata uvincha vitecha. Even though I should have said that a child who doesn't have an understanding of what they're doing, who doesn't really want to violate a malacha at all when they're turning on and off the lights, I should have said that is not a malacha's machsheves, that is not called a malacha at all, and it should be totally permissible. Says the Pasuk, no, ata uvincha vitecha, this is an exception to the rule, and children have to keep to the laws of Shabbos, even if they don't realize what it is that they are doing in practice. Okay? Yeah. That's a very relevant question, and it's a question that we are faced with all the time. So it depends what. Look, every Jew has an obligation. Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh BaZeh. We all have an obligation to each other. Now, if I see somebody doing something that is not proper, I'm supposed to point it out to them. There are rules and regulations when we say that. First of all, it has to be said in the proper way. The Gemara says mitzvah. Kishem shemitzvah lomar davar hanishma, the same way we're supposed to say something that people will listen to, mitzvah shalom lomar davar shalom nishma. You shouldn't say something if you know people are just going to laugh at you and they're not going to accept it. And often that is the case. We have children who go study for the year in Israel and they come back and tell their parents the whole house is treif and everything's wrong. Now, number one, is the whole house really treif? Probably not. Are they really violating every law of Shabbos? Probably not. So you picked up chumras and you found certain things. All right, not everybody's up to the chumras, and you're not either up to the chumras. So it's a very complicated issue. If there's something outright that is going on, that is that a child believes they would be able to fix if they said it in the right way, then maybe a child has a right to do that. But barring that example, I would say, you know, it's better not to say. I think it really is a big turnoff for people. I think it's most often not said in the right way. And it's most often not done after the child points it out because the parents are just angry at them. And then it just causes tension and the children are angry, the parents are angry. It's a big problem. It's a big problem. I wish they taught that in Israel. So they should teach the laws of how to tell your parents the things that are bothering you. Yes?
It's the same concept when you come in your house.
Yeah. It depends. So you have a guest in your house. Let's say the Shabbos project, right? So this was a major question. You're going to have a guest in your house who's certainly not going to follow the laws of Shabbos. So number one, who said you're allowed to invite that person to your house when you know they're going to drive to your house and you know whatever? So that's a major question. My father was of the opinion, and I spoke to Rav Asher Weiss about it as well. They both felt, look, you're going to have the person in your house for 3 hours. The amount of malacha they would have done had they been home was far more than the malacha they're going to do in your house. So you're not setting them up for doing an aveira on Shabbos, you're setting them up to save them from 3 hours of malacha on Shabbos. If they were home, they would be turning on and off the TV, driving to and from the store, going to the movie theater, writing something down, doing all kinds of malachas that they wouldn't even think twice, on their cell phone the whole time. From the fact that they're in your home, and you tell them, look, we keep Shabbos, this is what we expect of you. You're going to come to our house, we don't want you talking on the phone the whole time while we're having a meal, just sit with us for the next 3 hours. You're saving them, in a sense, from violating something that is far worse. And therefore, there's an argument to be made that it really would make sense to engage with them and to have them come to your home, even though it's going to mean that they're going to drive to your home. But in the bigger picture, you're really saving them from doing many more Isurim on Shabbos than you are by having them drive to your house. But at the same time, if informing them of a halacha is really not going to impact the way that they keep Shabbos at all, and now what's going to happen is they're just going to either laugh at you, or they're now every time they violate the Avera, they're going to do it willingly, as opposed to before they were aware of it, they were doing it without knowledge. So there's an argument to be made that we just shouldn't inform people if that's something. I think it's an important concept in general. When you inform people of certain areas of halacha, if you think there's a chance that people are going to keep it, then you teach those areas of halacha. If you think there's a chance that nobody is going to abide by it at all, the Gemara says, once in a while we have a concept, mutav shiyu shogim v'al yiyu mezidim. It's better that people should remain ignorant, and when they violate this principle, they don't know that they're violating an avera, than for you to inform them, and then every time they do it in the future, they're doing it willingly. So that's a... you have to know when to apply that concept and when not. So let's go a little bit further. Let's go a little further in the 7 minutes we have left. We have a Gemara Maseches Krisos where the Gemara tells us the only time you're obligated to bring a carbon chatas, the only time you have to bring a carbon to atone for a sin that you did inadvertently, is when you did it inadvertently. But what if you do it bimis asik? What if I do it and I have absolutely no idea that I'm doing something wrong? For example, my last name is Schechter. So the example that's given in the Rishonim is the following. I guess somebody down the line in my family was a shochet, I would imagine. So you have somebody who's a shochet here in Woodmere. Every day, everybody from the neighborhood comes with their cow, and they ask that the shochet should please shech the cow. I shech the cow, I give it back to the family, they make a big barbecue. So everybody's coming in, I'm shechting all the cows, and I don't make anything of it. Why should I think anything of it? Just so happens to be, I shecht an animal, and then the person tells me, oh, I can't believe I just gave you that animal. I say, what do you mean? What's the problem with the animal? He says, just yesterday, I designated this animal to be a carbon to bring to the Beis HaMikdash. It belongs to Hagdish. It doesn't. We're not allowed to shecht it here. You have to shecht in the Beis HaMikdash. I can't believe it. That's what we call shchut echutz. You shechted an animal that had to be shechted in one specific place in the Beis HaMikdash on the Mizbeach, and instead, you did it here in Woodmere. You did it in New York. So, at the time that I shechted it, I had absolutely no idea. How should I know that? I was doing what I normally do. Everybody brings me the cow. I shecht the cow. I give it back to them. That's the same thing that I did. You didn't inform me that I was doing something wrong. You didn't tell me in advance that this was an animal that's not allowed to be shechted here in New York. So in a case like that, the Gemara says, no reason to bring a carbon. Yes, you may have, it seems that you did something wrong, because after all, you weren't allowed to shecht the animal here in New York. But I had no idea. How was I supposed to know that? I was doing what I normally do. I was doing what I do every day of the week. And therefore, we assume you would not be held responsible for that. I remember as a child, there was somebody who ate in our home, a newlywed couple, and they decided that they were going to take a honeymoon to Israel. They hadn't been there in years. Both the boy and the girl hadn't been there in a long time. They were going to take a honeymoon to Israel. Now, they signed up. There was some advertisement that the Young Israel National Council was making a trip, and you could join the tour for a certain amount of money, and that's what they did. So they joined the tour. They booked this like 8 months in advance. 6 months later, they get a message from, I think it was before email, they got a message from whatever trip coordinator it was. You were the only two people that signed up, and therefore we have canceled the tours. We can't have a tour with two people. However, we have very graciously tacked you onto another tour program that will take care of you, and they will add you into all of their programs. Very nice. So I remember the Shabbos after they came back from this trip, they ate by my parents' home. Listen what happens. So they go on this trip, and they were the only two Jews on the trip. So they're the only two Jews on the trip. Now, when you have a non-Jewish trip that's touring around Israel, they're going to look at many different sites that a Jew normally would not look at. So one of the days, they bring them to the Har HaBayis. They bring them to the mosque, and they start showing them. And these two Jews keep asking the tour guide, so please tell us, where is the place where we're not allowed to walk? And he's looking at them, what are you talking about? Why wouldn't you be allowed to walk? And they say, no, we're not allowed to go certain places in the Har HaBayis. And he said, no, everything's fine. Don't worry, I don't know what... He thought they meant security concerns. They meant halacha considerations. He wasn't a Jewish tour guide. Nobody else on the trip was Jewish. So he didn't have any guidelines of where he's allowed to take them or not. So he's walking them in and out of the mosque. He's showing them all the different parts of the Har HaBayis. He's giving them the whole history and the tour. That Friday night, when they came back, they come to eat by my parents, and they say, you wouldn't believe it. We went on this great trip, and we were walking around the Har HaBayis, and my father's like fainting at the table. He couldn't believe it. And he says, did you go to the mikveh that morning? Did you have any idea? You weren't allowed to go in. you know, did you wear your shoes? All the regulations that we have, they said, we had no idea. We kept asking the tour guide whether or not we're allowed to walk here. He kept saying yes, so we assumed this wasn't part of the problem. Unusual story. Doesn't happen that often, but it's discussed in the Gemara. The Gemara says, I walk into the Har HaBayis and I think it's a movie theater. I walk into the Har HaBayis and I think it's a baseball stadium and I think it's a shul. I have no idea that you have to go to the mikveh before you come to the Har HaBayis. I had no idea you have to take your shoes off. I had no idea there's a certain mode of conduct that's expected of me when I go to this place because I simply had no idea where I was. So that is what we refer to as misasik. That is something... person is totally oblivious. I'm totally unaware to what I'm doing. And the Gemara discusses, do I have to bring a carbon for that or not? After all, it's only a misasik. Why should a carbon be necessary? So this is a very important issue when it comes to Shabbos as well. What is misasik on Shabbos? Let's say, for example, a person leans on a wall. You walk into a house, you lean on the wall, and happens to be the light goes on. I had no idea that by leaning on the wall, I was going to bump into something that was going to bump into something else that was going to turn the light on. That's a misasik. I had no idea by opening the door, the light was going to go on. I was going to activate a whole system. That's called a misasik, and that is not a problem at all. And the same applies, let's say a person has something, the Gemara discusses, let's say a person has something that they carry in their pocket, a dirty tissue, and there is no Erev. So I carry a tissue in my pocket, I had no idea that the tissue was there, and now I go outside and I come back in, and after I take my jacket off, I realize I had a tissue in my pocket. What would you say? Do I have to bring a karban for violating the malacha of Hotzah on Shabbos? The answer is, no. Why? Because I was a misasek. I had no idea that there was a tissue in my pocket. I had no idea I was carrying anything. If the case would be changed, if a person would walk outside carrying something in their hand, and they simply didn't know that there was a malacha to carry on Shabbos, if he just didn't know there was anything wrong with that, that's called shogeg. That's violating an aver inadvertently, and that's where a carbon would be required. But here, where we're talking about a case where you had no idea that you even had anything in your pocket, that would not be a problem, and there's no tshuva necessary for that at all. That is called a misasek. That is a person who does something without even knowing, without any awareness at all, that there's something happening. Yeah.
What do we substitute today for a carbon chatas?
What do we substitute today for a carbon chatas? The Rama says that today, a person is supposed to give tzedakah, the same amount of money that the carbon would cost you. Now, nobody really knows what a carbon would cost. Every time you do an aver, you have to bring a big cow. It'd be a few $100 every time you turn the lights on Shabbos. It's a big problem. So the truth is, the Gemara says in Maseches Shabbos that you really should be writing down every time you do an aver, because when the Beis Hamikdash is going to be rebuilt, we're going to have to make up for all these terrible times that we violated the laws of Shabbos. Nobody does that. The question is why we don't do it. It's a shir in and of itself. I don't know exactly, but you certainly should do tshuva. You certainly, next time you say Slach Lanu on Sunday morning, you should think about it. Or Matzai Shabbos, think about the fact that I've done something wrong, and I'll try to be more careful next time. We don't generally have an opportunity to offer karbanos today. So, we have this concept of misasik. And as we mentioned, misasik applies b'chol ha-Torah kula. It applies by all the laws of the Torah. So somebody does something like shchutei chutz, you shecht an animal, you had no idea that the animal was supposed to be shechted only a particular place. That is not considered an avera at all. That is called a misasik, a person who is totally unaware, totally oblivious. That applies to Shabbos as well. That applies to Shabbos as well, and therefore, if I walk into a room and I inadvertently turned on all the lights because I was totally oblivious to the makeup of the room, the structure of this home, I would assume that that is called a misasik, and that is not called an avera at all. However, let's say another example. The Gemara gives, I'm not allowed to throw something from my property into somebody else's property unless there's an Erev. So let's say I had no idea that this is somebody else's property. So I take a ball and I throw it across the backyard. I didn't know that halfway through the backyard is somebody else's property. Okay, how was I supposed to know that? So that's called a misasik. I threw a ball and I had no idea that by doing so, I was violating a malach on Shabbos. That's called a misasik, nothing wrong at all. Doesn't mean you should go ahead and do it. Means you should educate yourself. But if it was done, that's not called an aver. But now the Gemara goes even further. The Gemara says, yes, that's the law that applies across the board by all averus in the Torah. It's called a misasik. Somebody does something with a total lack of awareness, totally not knowing anything about what's happening. That's not called an aver at all. We go to Shabbos and it becomes even more kal. By Shabbos, we assume it goes even 10 steps further. Why is that? So let's say the following example. The Gemara says, because on Shabbos we require meleches machsheves, because on Shabbos everything that we violate has to be done with specific intent, therefore we have the following conclusion. I come to my home on Shabbos Friday night. and I totally forgot we don't have any dessert, and the gourmet glot or Seasons fruit platter wasn't ordered before Shabbos, and now we have nothing to serve the guests. And I'm ashamed, and I don't know what to do. I tell my wife, go run outside. We have all kinds of fruit trees outside, apples and oranges and pears and tomatoes. So I tell her, that's a vegetable, I got it. So you have to... So I tell my wife, you know, look, I don't want to be embarrassed from all of the guests that we have. You know, we got to serve some fresh fruit, something. Go outside and pick a whole basket full of apples. Now, everybody would agree that that's not permissible on Shabbos. That's called kotzer. You're detaching something from the ground. That's absolutely not allowed. But I don't care if it's allowed or not. I tell my wife, look, I don't want to be embarrassed from all the guests. Violate the laws of Shabbos. I don't care. Go outside, pick a bunch of apples, and we'll serve them at the table. My wife goes outside. It's an early Friday night. It's too early. It's already too dark outside. She can't really see what she's picking. So she goes outside, starts picking things, comes inside. Lo and behold, it's a whole box full of oranges. So she went to the orange tree instead of the apple tree. And all we wanted was apples. We didn't want oranges. Says the Gemara, that is something that's called a misasek on Shabbos. You would not be held responsible. Even though I knew with certainty that I was walking outside and I had every intention to do something wrong and I wanted to pick the fruits off the tree because I needed to do it in order that my guests shouldn't embarrass me and I wanted to do the thing that I did wrong. But it didn't turn out the way I wanted it to be. It turned out being oranges instead of apples. Turned out to be pears instead of the oranges, something else. That is not a melechas machsheves. That is something that is also called a misasek, and that's a tremendous chiddush. That's 10 steps further than anything we have said until now. Normally what we refer to is something where I'm simply unaware of the consequence that's going to happen. I don't know that by walking into the room the light's going to go on. That's called a misasek, that's not an aveira. But here we're describing a case where I do know that I'm doing something wrong. And I know that the Torah says on Shabbos I'm not allowed to pluck a fruit off of a tree. However, I thought I was getting apples and it turns out I got oranges, which I didn't want. In such a case, the Gemara says, that is also called a misasek. And when it comes to Shabbos, because Shabbos is governed by the laws of meleches machsheves, one has to know clearly the intent of what they're doing and the consequence of the action that you're doing and exactly what's going to happen. Therefore, we assume if you do something like that, even though I knew that I was doing something wrong, but I had no intention to do this wrong, I assume that that is also considered to be only a misasek. That is not considered an aveira. I know you have to swallow it, you have to think about it. There is a lot to think about, and it's hard to figure out where that applies and where it doesn't. So do you just tell a person, do whatever you want on Shabbos because I wasn't thinking about it? No, that's not the answer. But this is generally the concept of misasek, and I'm glad that we got into it because I think it's a concept that is very important in halacha in general. When a person does something with absolutely no intent, when a person does something without knowing at all what it is that they're doing or the consequence of that activity, that is not called an aveir at all. Amir Tzashem, we will pick up in 2 weeks, as next week I'm going to be in Eretz Yisrael. I'm not around, but we will pick up where we left off.